Wayne tugged his arm firmly. Come on. Larry got all the miles he had felt he could walk, except that he no longer felt that way. He had an ugly headache and his spine felt as if it had turned to glass. His eyeballs were pulsing and his kidneys ached dully. An amphetamine hangover is not as painful as the morning after the night you got through a whole fifth of Four Roses, but it is not as pleasant as, say, bawling Raquel Welch would be. If he had another couple of uppers, he could climb neatly up on top of this eight ball that wanted to run him down. He reached in his pocket to get them, and for the first time became aware that he was clad only in skivvies that had been fresh 3 days ago. Wayne, I want to go back. Let's walk a little more. He thought that Wayne was looking at him strangely, with a mixture of exasperation and pity. No, man, I only got my skivvies on. I'll get picked up for indecent exposure. On this part of the coast, you could wrap a bandana around your wing-wang and let your balls hang free and still not get picked up for indecent exposure. Come on, man. I'm tired, Larry said querulously. He began to feel pissed at Wayne. This was Wayne's way of getting back at him, because Larry had a hit, and he, Wayne, only had a keyboard credit on the new album. He was no different than Julie. Everybody hated him now. Everyone had the knife out. His eyes blurred with easy tears. Come on, man, Wayne repeated, and they struck off up the beach again. They had walked perhaps another mile when double cramps struck the big muscles in Larry's thighs. He screamed and collapsed onto the sand. It felt as if twin stilettos had been planted in his flesh at the same instant. Cramps, he screamed. Oh, man, cramps. Wayne squatted beside him and pulled his legs out straight. The agony hit again, and then Wayne went to work, hitting the knotted muscles, kneading them. At last, the oxygen-starved tissues began to loosen. Larry, who had been holding his breath, began to gasp. Oh, man, he said. Thanks. That was bad. Sure, Wayne said, without much sympathy. I bet it was, Larry. How are you now? Okay, but let's just sit, huh? Then we'll go back. I want to talk to you. I had to get you out here, and I wanted you straight enough so you could understand what I was laying on you. What's that, Wayne? He thought, here it comes, the pitch. But what Wayne said seemed so far from a pitch that for a moment he was back with the Superboy comic, trying to make sense of a six-word sentence. The party's got to end, Larry. Huh? The party. When you go back, you pull all the plugs, give everybody their car keys, and see them out the front door. Get rid of them. I can't do that, Larry said, shocked. You better, Wayne said. But why? Man, this party's just getting going. Larry, how much has Columbia paid you up front? Why would you want to know? Larry asked slyly. Do you really think I want to suck off you, Larry? Think. Larry thought, and with dawning bewilderment he realized there was no reason why Wayne Stuckey would want an arm on him. He hadn't really made it yet. He was scuffling like most of the people who had helped Larry cut the album, but unlike most of them, Wayne came from a family with money, and he was on good terms with his people. Wayne's father owned half of the country's third largest electronic games company, and the Stuckeys had a modestly palatial home in Bel Air. Bewildered, Larry realized that his own sudden good fortune probably looked like small bananas to Wayne. No, I guess not, he said gruffly. I'm sorry, but it seems like every tinhorn cockroach chaser west of Las Vegas. So how much? Larry thought it over. $7,000 up front, all told. They're paying you quarterly royalties on the single and biannually on the album? Right. Wayne nodded. They hold it until the eagle screams, the bastards. Cigarette? Larry took one and cupped the end for a light. Do you know how much this party's costing you? Sure, Larry said. You didn't rent the house for less than $1,000. Yeah, that's right. It had actually been $1,200 plus $500 damage deposit. He had paid the deposit and half the month's rent, a total of $1,100 with $600 owing. How much for dope? Wayne asked. Oh, man, you gotta have something. It's like cheese for Ritz crackers. There was pot and there was Coke. How much? Come on. The fucking DA, Larry said sulkily. 500 and 500. And it was gone the second day. The hell it was, Larry said, startled. I saw two bowls when we went out this morning, man. Most of it was gone, yeah, but... Man, don't you remember the deck? Wayne's voice suddenly dropped into an amazingly good parody of Larry's own drawling voice. Just put it on my tab, Dewey. Keep 'em full. Larry looked at Wayne with dawning horror. He did remember a small, wiry guy with a peculiar haircut, a whiffle cut, they had called it 10 or 15 years ago. A small guy with a whiffle haircut and a T-shirt reading, Jesus is coming and is he pissed. This guy seemed to have good dough practically falling out of his asshole. He could even remember telling this guy, Dewey the deck, to keep his hospitality bowls full and put it on his tab. But that had been... Well, that had been days ago. Wayne said, You're the best thing to happen to Dewey Deck in a long time, man. How much is he into me for? Not bad on pot. Pot's cheap, 1,200. 8 grand on coke. For a minute, Larry thought he was going to puke. He goggled silently at Wayne. He tried to speak, and he could only mouth, 9,200? Inflation, man, Wayne said. You want the rest? Larry didn't want the rest, but he nodded. There was a color TV upstairs. Somebody ran a chair through it. I'd guess 300 for repairs. The wood paneling downstairs has been gouged to hell, 400. The picture window facing the beach got broken the day before yesterday, 300. The shag rug in the living room is totally kaput. Cigarette burns, beer, whiskey, 400. I called the liquor store, and they're just as happy with their tab as the deck is with his, 600. 600 for booze? Larry whispered. Blue horror had encased him up to the neck. Be thankful most of them have been scoffing beer and wine. You've got a $400 tab down at the market, mostly for pizza, chips, tacos, all that good shit. But the worst is the noise. Pretty soon the cops are going to land. Les flics. Disturbing the peace. And you've got 4 or 5 heavies doing up on heroin. There's 3 or 4 ounces of Mexican brown in the place. Is that on my tab, too? Larry asked hoarsely. No. The deck doesn't mess with heroin. That's an organization item, and the deck doesn't like the idea of cement cowboy boots. But if the cops land, you can bet the bust will go on your tab. But I don't know. Just a babe in the woods, yeah. But your total tab for this little shindy, so far, comes to over $12,000, Wayne said. You went out and picked that Z off the lot. How much did you put down? 25, Larry said numbly. He felt like crying. So what have you got until the next royalty check? A couple thousand? That's about right, Larry said, unable to tell Wayne he had less than that. About 800, split evenly between cash and checking. Larry, you listen to me because you're not worth telling twice. There's always a party waiting to happen. Out here, the only two constants are the constant bullshitting that goes on and the constant party. They come running like dicky birds looking for bugs on a hippo's back. Now they're here. Pick them off your carcass and send them on their way. Larry thought of the dozens of people in the house. He knew maybe 1 person in 3 at this point. The thought of telling all those unknown people to leave made his throat want to close up. He would lose their good opinion. Opposing this thought came an image of Dewey Deck refilling the hospitality bowls, taking a notebook from his back pocket and writing it all down at the bottom of his tab. Him and his whiffle haircut and his trendy T-shirt. Wayne watched him calmly as he squirmed between these two pictures. Man, I'm going to look like the asshole of the world, Larry said finally, hating the weak and petulant words as they fell from his mouth. Yeah, they'll call you a lot of names. They'll say you're going Hollywood, getting a big head, forgetting your old friends. Except none of them are your friends, Larry. Your friends saw what was happening 3 days ago and split the scene. It's no fun to watch a friend who's, like, pissed his pants and doesn't even know it. So why tell me? Larry asked, suddenly angry. The anger was prodded out of him by the realization that all his really good friends had taken off. and in retrospect, all their excuses seemed lame. Barry Grieg had taken him aside, had tried to talk to him, but Larry had been really flying, and he had just nodded and smiled indulgently at Barry. Now he wondered if Barry had been trying to lay the same rap on him. It made him embarrassed and angry to think so. "Why tell me?" he repeated. "I get the feeling you don't like me so very goddamn much." "I don't dislike you either. Beyond that, man, I couldn't say. I could have let you get your nose punched on this. Once would have been enough for you." "What do you mean?" "You tell them, because there's a hard streak in you. There's something in you that's like biting on tin foil. Whatever it takes to make success, you've got it. You'll have a nice little career. Middle-of-the-road pop no one will remember in 5 years. The junior high boppers will collect your records. You'll make money." Larry balled his fists on his legs. He wanted to punch that calm face. Wayne was saying things that made him feel like a small pile of dog shit beside a stop sign. "Go on back and pull the plug," Wayne said softly. "Then you get in that car and go. Just go, man. Stay away until you know that next royalty check is waiting for you." "But Dewey, I'll find a man to talk to Dewey, my pleasure man. The guy will tell Dewey to wait for his money like a good little boy, and Dewey will be happy to oblige." He paused, watching two small children in bright bathing suits run up the beach. A dog ran beside them, ralphing loudly at the blue sky. Larry stood up and forced himself to say thanks. The sea breeze slipped in and out of his aging shorts. The word came out of his mouth like a brick. "You just go away somewhere and get your shit together," Wayne said, standing up beside him, still watching the children. "You've got a lot of shit to get together. What kind of manager you want, what kind of tour you want, what kind of contract you want after Pocket Savior hits. If you give yourself some room, you'll figure it all out. Guys like you always do. Guys like you always do. Guys like me always do. Guys like..." Somebody was tapping a finger on the window. Larry jerked, then sat up. A bolt of pain went through his neck, and he winced at the dead, cramped feel of the flesh there. He had been asleep, not just dozing, reliving California. But here and now it was gray New York daylight, and the finger tapped again. He turned his head cautiously and painfully and saw his mother, wearing a black net scarf over her hair, peering in. For a moment, they just stared at each other through the glass, and Larry felt curiously naked, like an animal being looked at in the zoo. Then his mouth took over, smiling, and he cranked the window down. "Mom?" "I knew it was you," she said in a queerly flat tone. "Come on out and let me see you standing up." Both legs had gone to sleep, and pins and needles tingled up from the balls of his feet as he opened the door and got out. He had never expected to meet her this way, unprepared and exposed. He felt like a sentry who had fallen asleep at his post, suddenly called to attention. He had somehow expected his mother to look smaller, less sure of herself, a trick of the years that had matured him and left her just the same. But it was almost uncanny the way she had caught him. When he was 10, she used to wake him up on Saturday mornings after she thought he had slept long enough by tapping one finger on his closed bedroom door. She had awakened him that same way 14 years later, sleeping in his new car like a tired kid who tried to stay up all night and got caught by the Sandman in an undignified position. Now he stood before her, his hair corkscrewed, a faint and rather foolish grin on his face. Pins and needles still coursed up his legs, making him shift from foot to foot. He remembered that she always asked him if he had to go to the bathroom when he did that, and now he stopped the movement and let the needles prick him at will. "Hi, Mom," he said. She looked at him without saying anything, and a dread suddenly roosted in his heart like an evil bird coming back to an old nest. It was a fear that she might turn away from him, deny him, show him the back of her cheap coat, and simply go off to the subway around the corner, leaving him. Then she sighed, the way a man will sigh before picking up a heavy bundle. And when she spoke, her voice was so natural and so mildly, rightly pleased that he forgot his first impression. "Hi, Larry," she said. "Come on upstairs. I knew it was you when I looked out the window. I already called in sick at the building. I got sick time coming." She turned to lead him back up the steps between the vanished stone dogs. He came 3 steps behind her, catching up, wincing at the pins and needles. Mom? She turned back to him, and he hugged her. For a moment, an expression of fright crossed her features, as if she expected to be mugged rather than hugged. Then it passed, and she accepted his embrace and gave back her own. The smell of her sachet slipped up his nose, evoking unexpected nostalgia, fierce, sweet, and bitter. For a moment, he thought he was going to cry, and was smugly sure that she would. It was a touching moment. Over her sloped right shoulder, he could see the dead cat lying half in and half out of the garbage can. When she pulled away, her eyes were dry. Come on, I'll make you some breakfast. Have you been driving all night? Yes, he said, his voice slightly hoarse with emotion. Well, come on. Elevator's broken, but it's only 2 floors. It's worse for Mrs. Halsey with her arthritis. She's on 5. Don't forget to wipe your feet. If you track in, Mr. Freeman will be on me like a shot. I swear Goshen, he can smell dirt. Dirt's his enemy, all right. They were on the stairs now. Come on, can you eat 3 eggs? I'll make toast, too, if you don't mind Roman meal. Come on. He followed her past the vanished stone dogs and looked at where they had been a little wildly, just to reassure himself that they were really gone, that he had not shrunk 2 feet, that the whole decade of the 1970s had not vanished back into time. She pushed the doors open, and they went in. Even the dark brown shadows and the smells of cooking were the same. Alice Underwood fixed him 3 eggs, bacon, toast, juice, coffee. When he had finished all but the coffee, he lit a cigarette and pushed back from the table. She flashed the cigarette a disapproving look, but said nothing. That restored some of his confidence, but not much. She had always been good at biding her time. She dropped the iron spider skillet into the gray dishwasher, and it hissed a little. She hadn't changed much, Larry was thinking. A little older, she would be 51 now. A little grayer, but there was still plenty of black left in that sensibly netted head of hair. She was wearing a plain gray dress, probably the one she worked in. Her bosom was still the same large comber blooming out of the bodice of the dress. A little larger, if anything. Mom, tell me the truth. Has your bosom gotten bigger? Is that the fundamental change? He started to tap cigarette ashes into his coffee saucer. She jerked it away and replaced it with the ashtray she always kept in the cupboard. The saucer had been sloppy with coffee, and it had seemed okay to tap in it. This ashtray was clean, reproachfully spotless, and he tapped into it with a slight pang. She could bide her time, and she could keep springing small traps on you until your ankles were all bloody and you were ready to start gibbering. So you came back, Alice said, taking a used Brillo from a table-talk pie dish and putting it to work on the skillet. What brought you? Well, Ma, this friend of mine clued me into the facts of life. The assholes travel in packs, and this time they were after me. I don't know if friend is the right word for him. He respects me musically about as much as I respect the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. But he got me to put on my traveling shoes, and wasn't it Robert Frost who said home is a place that when you go there they have to take you in? Aloud, he said, I guess I got missing you, Mom. She snorted. That's why you wrote me often? I'm not much of a letter writer. He pumped his cigarette slowly up and down. Smoke rings formed from the tip and drifted off. You can say that again. Smiling, he said, I'm not much of a letter writer. But you're still smart to your mother. That hasn't changed. I'm sorry, he said. How have you been, Mom? She put the skillet in the drainer, pulled the sink stopper, and wiped the lace of soap suds from her reddened hands. Not so bad, she said, coming over to the table and sitting down. My back pains me some, but I got my pills. I make out all right. You haven't thrown it out of whack since I left? Oh, once, but Dr. Holmes took care of it. Mom, those chiropractors are... just frauds. He bit his tongue. A what? He shrugged uncomfortably in the face of her hooked smile. You're free, white, and 21. If it helps you, fine. She sighed and took a roll of wintergreen lifesavers from her dress pocket. I'm a lot more than 21, and I feel it. Want one? He shook his head at the lifesaver she had thumbed up. She popped it into her own mouth instead. You're just a girl yet, he said with a touch of his old bantering flattery. She had always liked it, but now it only brought a ghost of a smile to her lips. Any new men in your life? Several, she said. How about you? No, he said seriously. No new men. Some girls, but no new men. He had hoped for laughter, but only got the ghost smile again. I'm troubling her, he thought. That's what it is. She doesn't know what I want here. She hasn't been waiting for 3 years for me to show up after all. She only wanted me to stay lost. Same old Larry, she said, never serious. You're not engaged, seeing anyone steadily? I play the field, Mom. You always did. At least you never came home to tell me you'd got some nice Catholic girl in a family way. I'll give you that. You were either very careful, very lucky, or very polite. He strove to keep a poker face. It was the first time in his life that she had ever mentioned sex to him, directly or obliquely. Anyway, you're going to learn, Alice said. They say bachelors have all the fun. Not so. You just get old and full of sand, nasty, the way that Mr. Freeman is. He's got that sidewalk-level apartment, and he's always standing there in the window hoping for a strong breeze. Larry grunted. I hear that song you got on the radio. I tell people, that's my son. That's Larry. Most of them don't believe it. You've heard it? He wondered why she hadn't mentioned it first. Sure, all the time on that rock and roll station the young girls listen to, WABC. Do you like it? As well as I like any of that music. She looked at him firmly. I think some of it sounds suggestive, lewd. He found himself shuffling his feet and forced himself to stop. It's just supposed to sound passionate, Mom, that's all. His face suffused with blood. He had never expected to be sitting in his mother's kitchen discussing passion. The place for passion's the bedroom, she said curtly, closing off any aesthetic discussion of his hit record. Also, you did something to your voice. You sound like a nigger. Now? He asked, amused. No, on the radio. That brown sound, it sure do get around, Larry said, smiling. Just like that, she said, nodding. When I was a girl, we thought Frank Sinatra was daring. Now they have this disco. Disco, they call it. Screaming, I call it. She looked at him grudgingly. At least there's no screaming on your record. I get a royalty, he said. A certain percent of every record sold. It breaks down to... Oh, go on, she said, and made a shooing gesture with her hand. I flunked all my maths. Have they paid you yet, or did you get that little car on credit? They haven't paid me much, he said, skating up to the edge of the lie, but not quite over it. I made a down payment on the car. I'm financing the rest. Easy credit terms, she said balefully. That's how your father ended up a bankrupt. The doctor said he died of a heart attack, but it wasn't that. It was a broken heart. Your dad went to the poorhouse on easy credit terms. This was an old rap, and Larry just let it flow over him, nodding at the right places. His father had owned a haberdashery. A Robert Hall had opened not far away, and a year later his business had failed. He had turned to food for solace, putting on 110 pounds in 3 years. He had dropped dead in the corner luncheonette when Larry was 9, a half-finished meatball sandwich on the plate in front of him. Then Alice brought Larry up, dominating his life with her proverbs and prejudices until he left home. Her last remark to him as he and Rudy Schwartz drove off in Rudy's old Ford was that they had poorhouses in California, too. Yes, sir, that's my mama. Do you want to stay here, Larry? She asked softly. Startled, he countered, Do you mind? There's room. The rollaway's still in the back bedroom. I've been storing things back there, but you could move some of the boxes around. All right, he said slowly. If you're sure you don't mind. I'm only in for a couple of weeks. I thought I'd look up some of the old guys. Mark, Galen, David, Chris, those guys. She got up, went to the window, and tugged it up. You're welcome to stay as long as you like, Larry. I'm not so good at expressing myself, maybe, but I'm glad to see you. We didn't say goodbye very well. There were harsh words. She showed him her face, still harsh, but also full of a terrible, reluctant love. For my part, I regret them. I only said them because I love you. I never knew how to say that just right, so I said it in other ways. That's all right, he said, looking down at the table. The flush was back. He could feel it. Listen, I'll chip in for stuff. You can if you want. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I'm working. Thousands aren't. You're still my son. He thought of the stiffening cat, half in and half out of the trash can, and of Dewey the deck, smilingly filling the hospitality bowls, and he suddenly burst into tears. As his hands blurred double in the wash of them, he thought that this should be her bit, not his. Nothing had gone the way he thought it would, nothing. She had changed after all. So had he, but not as he had expected. An unnatural reversal had occurred. She had gotten bigger, and he had somehow gotten smaller. He had not come home to her because he had to go somewhere. He had come home because he was afraid, and he wanted his mother. She stood by the open window, watching him. The white curtains fluttered in on the damp breeze, obscuring her face, not hiding it entirely, but making it seem ghostly. Traffic sounds came in through the window. She took the handkerchief from the bodice of her dress and walked over to the table and put it in one of his groping hands. There was something hard in Larry. These tears couldn't change that any more than a single summer cloudburst can change the shape of rock. There was something that gave you the bitter zing of biting on tinfoil or hearing chalk scree on a blackboard. Deep inside, looking out, was only Larry. He was the only one allowed inside his heart. But she loved him. She also thought there was good in Larry, great good. It was there, but this late on, it would take a catastrophe to bring it out. There was no catastrophe here, only her weeping son. You're tired, she said. Clean up. I'll move the boxes and you can sleep. I guess I'll go in today after all. She went down the short hall to the back room, his old bedroom, and Larry heard her grunting and moving boxes. He wiped his eyes slowly. The sound of traffic came in the window. He tried to remember the last time he had cried in front of his mother. He thought of the dead cat. She was right. He was tired. He had never been so tired. He went to bed and slept for nearly 18 hours. Chapter 6. It was late afternoon when Franny went out back to where her father was patiently weeding the peas and beans. She had been a late child, and he was in his 60s now, his white hair coming out from under the baseball cap he always wore. Her mother was in Portland, shopping for white gloves. Fran's best childhood friend, Amy Lauder, was getting married early next month. She looked down at her dad's back for a peaceful moment, just loving him. At this time of day, the light took on a special quality that she loved, a timeless quality that belonged only to that most fleeting main genus, early summer. She could think of that particular tone of light in the middle of January, and it would make her heart ache fiercely. The light of an early summer afternoon as it slipped toward dark had so many good things wrapped up in it. Baseball at the Little League Park, where Fred had always played third and batted cleanup. Watermelon, first corn, iced tea and chilled glasses. Childhood. Franny cleared her throat a little. Need a hand? He turned and grinned. Caught me digging, didn't you? I guess I did. Is your mother back yet? He frowned vaguely, and then his face cleared. No, that's right. She just went, didn't she? Sure, pitch a hand if you want to. Just don't forget to wash up afterward. A lady's hands proclaim her habits, Fran mocked lightly, and snorted. Peter tried to look disapproving and did a poor job of it. She got down in the row next to him and began to weed. Sparrows were twittering, and there was a constant hum of traffic on US 1, less than a block from here. It hadn't reached the volume it would in July, when there would be a fatal accident nearly every day between here and Kittery, but it was building. Peter told her about his day, and she responded with the right questions. He was a machinist in the large Sanford auto parts firm, the largest auto parts firm north of Boston. He was 64 and about to start on his last year of work before retirement. A short year at that, because he had 4 weeks vacation time stockpiled, which he planned to take in September after the idiots went home. His voice switched from topic to topic, mellow and soothing. Their shadows grew longer, moving up the rows before them. She was lulled by it, as she always had been. She had come here to tell him something, but since earliest childhood, she had often come to tell and stayed to listen. He didn't bore her. So far as she knew, he didn't bore anyone, except possibly her mother. He was a storyteller, and a good one. She became aware that he had stopped talking. He was sitting on a rock at the end of his row, tamping his pipe and looking at her. "What's on your mind, Franny?" She looked at him dumbly for a moment, not sure how she should proceed. She had come out here to tell him, and now she wasn't sure if she could. The silence hung between them, growing larger, and at last it was a gulf she couldn't stand. She jumped. "I'm pregnant," she said simply. He stopped filling his pipe and just looked at her. "Pregnant," he said, as if he had never heard the word before. Then he said, "Oh, Franny, is it a joke or a game?" "No, Daddy." "Come over here." Obediently, she came up the row and sat next to him. There was a rock wall that divided their land from the town common next door. Beyond the rock wall was a tangled, sweet-smelling hedge that had long ago run wild in the most amiable way. Her head was pounding, and she felt a little sick to her stomach. "For sure?" he asked her. "For sure," she said. And then, there was no artifice in it, not a trace. She simply couldn't help it. She began to cry in great, braying sobs. He held her with one arm for what seemed to be a very long time. When her tears began to taper off, she forced herself to ask the question that troubled her the most. "Daddy, do you still like me?" "What?" He looked at her, puzzled. "Yes, I still like you fine, Franny." That made her cry again, but this time he let her tend herself while he got his pipe going. Borkum Riff began to ride slowly off on the faint breeze. "Are you disappointed?" she asked. "I don't know. I never had a pregnant daughter before, and I'm not sure just how I should take it." "Was it that Jess?" She nodded. "You told him?" She nodded again. "What did he say?" "He said he would marry me or pay for an abortion." "Marriage or abortion?" Peter Goldsmith said, and drew on his pipe. "He's a regular two-gun Sam." She looked down at her hands, splayed on her jeans. There was dirt in the small creases of the knuckles and dirt under the nails. A lady's hands proclaim her habits. The mental mother spoke up. "A pregnant daughter. I'll have to resign my membership in the church." A lady's hands. Her father said, "I don't want to get any more personal than I have to, but... Wasn't he, or you, being careful?" "I had birth control pills," she said. "They didn't work." "Then I can't put any blame unless it's on both of you," he said, looking at her closely. "And I can't do that, Franny. I can't lay blame. 64 has a way of forgetting what 21 was like. So we won't talk about blame." She felt a great relief come over her, and it was a little like swooning. "Your mother will have plenty to say about blame," he said. "And I won't stop her, but I won't be with her. Do you understand that?" She nodded. Her father never tried to oppose her mother anymore, not out loud. She had a sharp tongue, and when she was opposed, it sometimes got out of control, he had told Franny once. And when it was out of control, she just might take a notion to cut anyone with it and think of sorry too late to do the wounded much good. Franny had an idea that her father might have faced a choice many years ago. Continued opposition resulting in divorce or surrender. He had chosen surrender, but on his own terms. She asked quietly, "Are you sure you can stay out of this one, Daddy?" You asking me to take you apart, Fran? I don't know. What are you going to do about it? With Mom? No. With you, Franny. I don't know. Marry him? Two can live as cheap as one, that's what they say, anyway. I don't think I can do that. I think I've fallen out of love with him, if I ever was in. The baby? His pipe was drawing well now, and the smoke was sweet on the summer air. Shadows were gathering in the garden's hollows, and the crickets were beginning to hum. No, the baby isn't the reason why. It was happening anyway. Jesse is... She trailed off, trying to put her finger on what was wrong with Jesse, the thing that could be overlooked by the rush the baby was putting on her, the thing that could be buried now but would nonetheless rest unquiet for 6 months, 16 months, or 26, only to rise finally from its grave and attack them both. Marry in haste, repent in leisure, one of her mother's favorite sayings. He's weak, she said. I can't explain better than that. You don't really trust him to do right by you, do you, Franny? No, she said, thinking that her father had just gotten closer to the root of it than she had. She didn't trust Jesse, who came from money and wore blue chambray work shirts. Don't let your mother change your mind, then. She closed her eyes, her relief even greater this time. He had understood by some miracle. What do you think of me getting an abortion? She asked after a while. Listen, he said, and then fell paradoxically silent. But she was listening, and she heard a sparrow, crickets, the far high hum of a plane, someone calling for Jackie to come in now, a power mower, a car with a glass pack muffler accelerating down US 1. She was just about to ask him if he was all right when he took her hand and spoke. Franny, you've no business having such an old man for a father, but I can't help it. I never married until 1941, just before I went into the war. I was a little older than some of the others that went after Pearl Harbor. Some of them called me Pop. Your mother and I didn't get much of a chance for baby-making before I was shipped away. I got a 2-day pass in October of 1942 and didn't see her again until the war was over. When it was all over, I got my good job over in Sanford, and we settled down. He looked at her thoughtfully in the dusk light. Carla was different in those days. She didn't change until your brother Freddie died. Until then, she was young. She stopped growing after Freddie died. She slapped 3 coats of lacquer and 1 of quick-dry cement on her way of looking at things and called it good. Now she's like a guard in a museum of ideas. And if she sees anyone tampering with the exhibits, she gives them a lot of look out below. But she wasn't always like that. What was she like, Daddy? Why, he looked vaguely out across the garden. She was a lot like you, Franny. She got the giggles. We used to go down to Boston to see the Red Sox play, and during the 7th inning stretch, she'd go out with me to the concession and have a beer. Mama drank beer? Yes, she did. And she'd spent most of the 9th in the ladies and come out cussing me for making her miss the best part of the game. Franny tried to imagine her mother with a cup of Narragansett beer in one hand, looking up at her father and laughing, like a girl on a date. She simply couldn't do it. We tried for a long time to make a baby. Then, in 52, there came your brother, Fred. She just about loved that boy to death, Fran. She had a miscarriage in 55, and we both figured that was the end. Then you came along in 59, a month early, but just fine. And I just about loved you to death. We each had one of our own, but she lost hers. He fell silent, brooding. Fred Goldsmith had died in 1965. He had been 13, Franny 6. The man who hit Fred had been drunk. He had a long list of traffic violations, including speeding, driving so as to endanger, and driving under the influence. Fred had lived 7 days. I think abortion's too clean a name for it, Peter Goldsmith said. I told you I was an old man. You're not old, Daddy, she murmured. I am, he said roughly. I'm an old man trying to give a young daughter advice, and it's like a monkey trying to teach table manners to a bear. A drunk driver took my son's life 15 years ago, and my wife has never been the same since. I've always seen the question of abortion in terms of Fred. I seem to be helpless to see it any other way. Your mother would argue against it for all the standard reasons. Morality, she'd say. A morality that goes back 2,000 years. The right to life. All our Western morality is based on that idea. I've read the philosophers. I range up and down them like a housewife with a dividend check in the Sears and Roebuck store. Your mother sticks with the Reader's Digest, but it's me that ends up arguing from feeling and her from the codes of morality. I just see Fred. He was destroyed inside. There was no chance for him. These right-to-life biddies hold up the pictures of babies drowned in salt, of arms and legs scraped out onto a steel table. So what? The end of a life is never pretty. I just see Fred, lying in that bed for 7 days, everything that was ruined pasted over with bandages. Life is cheap. Abortion makes it cheaper. Not much help, huh? I don't want an abortion, she said quietly. For my own reasons. What are they? It's partly me, she said, lifting her chin slightly. Will you give it up, Franny?
I don't know.
Do you want to?
No, I want to keep it.
He was silent. She thought she felt his disapproval.
You're thinking of school, aren't you?
She asked. No, he said, standing up. He put his hands in the small of his back and grimaced pleasurably as his spine crackled. I was thinking we've talked enough, and that you don't have to make that decision just yet.
Mom's home, she said.
He turned to follow her gaze as the station wagon turned into the drive, the chrome winking in the day's last light. Carla saw them, beeped the horn, and waved cheerily.
I have to tell her, Franny said.
Yes, but give it a day or two, Franny.
All right.
She helped him pick up the gardening tools, and then they walked up toward the station wagon together. Chapter 7.
Just roll up your sleeve, Mr. Redmond, the pretty nurse with the dark hair said. This won't take a minute.
She was holding the blood pressure cuff in two gloved hands. Behind the plastic face mask, she was smiling as if they shared an amusing secret.
No, Stu said. The smile faltered a little. It's only your blood pressure. It won't take a minute.
No.
Doctor's orders, she said, becoming businesslike. Please.
If it's doctor's orders, let me talk to the doctor.
I'm afraid he's busy right now. If you'll just...
I'll wait, Stu said equably, making no move to unbutton his cuff.
This is only my job. You don't want to get me in trouble, do you?
This time she gave him a charming wave smile.
If you'll only let me...
I won't, Stu said. Go back and tell them. They'll send somebody. Looking troubled, the nurse went across to the steel door and turned a square key in a lock plate. The pump kicked on, the door shushed open, and she stepped through. As it closed, she gave Stu a final reproachful look. Stu gazed back blandly. When the door was closed, he got up and went restlessly to the window, double-paned glass and barred on the outside, but it was full dark now and there was nothing to see. He went back and sat down. He was wearing faded jeans and a checked shirt, and his brown boots with the stitching beginning to bulge up the sides. He ran a hand up the side of his face and winced disapprovingly at the prickle. They wouldn't let him shave, and he haired up fast. He had no objection to the tests themselves. What he objected to was being kept in the dark, kept scared. He wasn't sick, at least not yet, but scared plenty. There was some sort of snow job going on here, and he wasn't going to be a party to it anymore until somebody told him something about what had happened in Arnett and what that fellow Campion had to do with it. At least then he could base his fears on something solid. They had expected him to ask before now. He could read it in their eyes. They have certain ways of keeping things from you in hospitals. 4 years ago, his wife had died of cancer at the age of 27. It had started in her womb and then just raced up through her like wildfire. And Stu had observed the way they got around her questions, either by changing the subject or giving her information in large technical lumps. So he simply hadn't asked, and he could see it had worried them. Now it was time to ask, and he would get some answers, in words of one syllable.
He could fill in some of the blank spots on his own. Campion and his wife and child had something pretty bad. It hit you like the flu or a summer cold, only it kept on getting worse, presumably until you choked to death on your own phlegm or until the fever burned you down. It was highly contagious. They had come and got him on the afternoon of the 17th, 2 days ago. 4 army men and a doctor, polite but firm. There was no question of declining. All 4 of the army men had been wearing sidearms. That was when Stu Redmond started being seriously scared. There had been a regular caravan going out of Arnett and over to the airstrip in Braintree. Stu had been riding with Vic Palfrey, Hap, the Bruettes, Hank Carmichael and his wife, and 2 army officers. They were all crammed into an army station wagon, and the army guys wouldn't say boo no matter how hysterical Lila Bruette got. The other wagons were crammed, too. Stu hadn't seen all the people in them, but he had seen all 5 of the Hodges family, and Chris Ortega, brother of Carlos, the volunteer ambulance driver. Chris was the bartender down at the Indian Head. He had seen Parker Nason and his wife, the elderly people from the trailer park near Stu's house. Stu guessed that they had netted up everyone who had been in the gas station and everyone that the people from the gas station said they'd talked to since Campion crashed into the pumps. At the town limits, there had been 2 olive-green trucks blocking the road. Stu guessed that other roads going into Arnett might be blocked off, too. They were stringing barbed wire, and when they had the town fenced off, they would post sentries. So it was serious, deadly serious. He sat patiently in the chair by the hospital bed he hadn't had to use, waiting for the nurse to bring someone. The someone would try giving him the runaround first. Maybe by morning they would finally bring him a someone who would have enough authority to tell him the things he needed to know. He was a patient man. For something to do, he began to tick over the conditions of the people who had ridden to the airstrip with him. Norm had been the only obvious sick one, coughing, bringing up phlegm, feverish. The rest of them seemed to be suffering to a greater or lesser degree from the common cold. Luke Bruette was sneezing. Lila and Vic Palfrey had mild coughs. Hap had the sniffles and kept blowing his nose. They hadn't sounded much different from the first and second grade classes Stu remembered attending as a little boy, when at least 2/3 of the kids present seemed to have some kind of a bug. But the thing that scared him most of all, and maybe it was only coincidence, was what had happened just as they were turning onto the airstrip. The army driver had let out 3 sudden bellowing sneezes. Probably just coincidence. June was a bad time in East Central Texas for people with allergies. Or maybe the driver was just coming down with a common garden variety cold. Because something that could jump from one person to another that quickly. Their army escort had boarded the plane with them. They rode stolidly, refusing to answer any questions except as to destination. They were going to Atlanta. They would be told more there, a bald-faced lie. Beyond that, the army men refused to say. Hap had been sitting next to Stu on the flight, and he was pretty well sloshed. The plane was army too, strictly functional, but the booze and the food had been first-class airline stuff. Of course, instead of being served by a pretty stewardess, a plank-faced sergeant took your order, but if you could overlook that, you could get along pretty well. Even Lila Bruette had calmed down with a couple of grasshoppers in her. Hap leaned close, bathing Stu in a warm mist of scotch fumes.
"This is a pretty funny bunch of old boys, Stuart. Ain't a one of them under 50, nor one with a wedding ring. Career boys, low rank."
About 30 minutes before they touched down, Norm Bruette had some kind of a fainting spell, and Lila Bruette began to scream. 2 of the hard-faced stewards bundled Norm into a blanket and brought him around in fairly short order. Lila, no longer calm, continued to scream. After a while, she threw up her grasshoppers and the chicken salad sandwich she had eaten. 2 of the good old boys went expressionlessly about the job of cleaning it up.
"What is all this?" Lila screamed. "What's wrong with my man? Are we going to die? Are my babies going to die?"
She had 1 baby in a headlock under each arm, their heads digging into her plentiful breasts. Luke and Bobby looked frightened and uncomfortable and rather embarrassed at the fuss she was making.
"Why won't somebody answer me? Isn't this America?"
"Can't somebody shut her up?" Chris Ortega had grumbled from the back of the plane.
One of the army men had forced a glass of milk on her, and after that, Lila did shut up. She spent the rest of the ride looking out the window at the countryside passing far below, and Stu guessed there had been more than milk in that glass. When they touched down, there had been four Cadillac limousines waiting for them. The Arnett folks got into three of them, and their army escort had gotten into the fourth. Stu guessed that those good old boys with no wedding rings, or close relatives, probably, were now somewhere right in this building. The red light went on over his door. When the compressor, or whatever it was, had stopped, a man in one of the white spacesuits stepped through. Dr. Denninger. He was young. He had black hair, olive skin, sharp features, and a mealy mouth. "Patty Greer says you gave her some trouble," Denninger's chest speaker said as he clopped over to Stu. "She's quite upset." "No need for her to be," Stu said easily. It was hard to sound easy, but he felt it was important to hide his fear from this man. Denninger looked and acted like the kind of man who would ride his help and bully-rag them around, but lick spittle up to his superiors like an egg-suck dog. That kind of man could be pushed a ways if he thought you held the whip hand, but if he smelled fear on you, he would hand you the same old cake, a thin icing of, "I'm sorry I can't tell you more," on top, and a lot of contempt for stupid civilians who wanted to know more than what was good for them, underneath. "I want some answers," Stu said. "I'm sorry, but if you want me to cooperate, give me some answers. In time, you will be... I can make it hard for you." "We know that," Denninger said peevishly. "I simply don't have the authority to tell you anything, Mr. Redman. I know very little myself." "I guess you've been testing my blood, all those needles." "That's right," Denninger said warily. "What for?" "I can't tell you. I don't know myself." The peevish tone was back again, and Stu was inclined to believe him. He was nothing but a glorified technician on this job, and he didn't like it much. "They put my hometown under quarantine." "I know nothing about that." But Denninger cut his eyes away from Stu's, and this time Stu thought he was lying. "How come I haven't seen anything about it?" He pointed to the TV set bolted to the wall. "I beg your pardon?" "When they roadblock off a town and put barbed wire around it, that's news," Stu said. "Mr. Redman, if you'll only let Patty take your blood pressure..." "No," Stu said. "If you want any more from me, you better send two big strong men to get it. And no matter how many you send, I'm going to try to rip some holes in those germ suits. They don't look all that strong, you know it?" He made a playful grab at Denninger's suit, and Denninger skipped backward and nearly fell over. The speaker of his intercom emitted a terrified squawk, and there was a stir behind the double glass. "I guess you could knock me out, but that'd mix up your tests, wouldn't it?" "Mr. Redman, you're not being reasonable," Denninger answered. He was keeping a prudent distance away. "Your lack of cooperation may do your country a grave disservice. Do you understand me?" "No," Stu said. "Right now it looks to me like it's my country doing me a grave disservice. It's got me locked up in a hospital room in Georgia with a buttermouth little pissant doctor who doesn't know enough to shit or go blind. So you get your ass out of here and send somebody in to talk to me, or send enough boys to take what you need by force. I'll fight 'em. You can count on that." He sat perfectly still in his chair after Denninger left. The nurse didn't come back. Two strong orderlies did not appear to take his blood pressure by force. For the time being, they were leaving him to stew in his own juices. He got up and turned on the TV and watched it unseeingly. His fear was big inside him, a runaway elephant. For 2 days, he had been waiting to start sneezing, coughing, hawking black phlegm and spitting it into the commode. He wondered about the others, people he had known all his life, and wondered if any of them were as bad off as Campion had been. He thought of the dead woman and her baby in that old Chev, and he kept seeing Lila Bruett's face on the woman and little Cheryl Hodges' face on the baby. The TV squawked and crackled. His heart beat slowly in his chest. Finally, he could hear the sound of an air purifier sighing air into the room. He felt his fear twisting and turning inside him beneath his poker face. Sometimes it was big and panicky, trampling everything, the elephant. Sometimes it was small and gnawing, ripping with sharp teeth, the rat.
It was always with him. But it was 40 hours before they sent him a man who would talk. Chapter 8. On June 18th, 5 hours after he had talked to his cousin Bill Hapscombe, Joe Bob Brentwood pulled down a speeder on Texas Highway 40, about 25 miles east of Braintree. The speeder was Harry Trent of Braintree, an insurance man. He had been doing 65 miles per in a 50-mile-an-hour zone. Joe Bob gave him a speeding ticket. Trent accepted it humbly and then amused Joe Bob by trying to sell him insurance on his house and his life. Joe Bob felt fine. Dying was the last thing on his mind. Nevertheless, he was already a sick man. He had gotten more than gas at Bill Hapscombe's Texaco, and he gave Harry Trent more than a speeding summons. Harry, a gregarious man who liked his job, passed the sickness to more than 40 people during that day and the next. How many those 40 passed it to is impossible to say. You might as well ask how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. On June 19th, the day Larry Underwood came home to New York and the day that Franny Goldsmith told her father about her impending little stranger, Harry Trent stopped at an East Texas cafe called Babe's Quick Eat for lunch. He had the cheeseburger platter and a piece of Babe's delicious strawberry pie for dessert. He had a slight cold, an allergy cold maybe, and he kept sneezing and having to spit. In the course of the meal, he infected Babe, the dishwasher, the two truckers in the corner booth, the man who came in to deliver bread, the man who came in to change the records on the juke, and the sweet fang that waited his table. He left her a dollar tip that was crawling with death. On his way out, a station wagon pulled in. There was a roof rack on top, and the wagon was piled high with kids and luggage. The wagon had New York plates, and the driver, who rolled down his window to ask Harry how to get to U.S. 21 going north, had a New York accent. Harry gave the New York fellow very explicit directions on how to get to Highway 21. He also gave him the sickness. The New Yorker was Edward M. Norris, Lieutenant of Police, Detective Squad, in the New York precinct. This was his first real vacation in 5 years. He and his family had had a really fine time. The kids had been in Seventh Heaven at Disney World in Orlando, and the whole family would be dead by the second day of July. The Norris family had a quick eat at Babe's and then followed Harry Trent's admirable directions to Highway 21. Ed and his wife, Trish, marveled over Southern hospitality while the three kids colored in the back seat. That night they stayed in a Eustis, Oklahoma travel court. Ed and Trish infected the clerk. The kids, Marcia, Stanley, and Hector, infected the kids they played with on the tourist court's playground, kids bound for West Texas, Alabama, Arkansas, and Tennessee. Trish woke Ed up in the early morning hours to tell him that Heck the baby was sick. He had an ugly rasping cough and was running a fever. It sounded to her like the croup. Ed Norris groaned and told her to give the kid some aspirin. If the kid's goddamn croup could only have held off another 4 or 5 days, he could have had it in his very own house, and Ed would have been left with the memory of a perfect vacation. He could hear the poor kid through the connecting door, hacking away like a hound dog. Trish expected that Hector's symptoms would abate in the morning. Croup was a lying-down sickness. But by noon of the 20th, she admitted to herself that it wasn't happening. The aspirin wasn't controlling the fever. Poor Heck was just glassy-eyed with it. His cough had taken on a booming note she didn't like, and his respiration sounded labored and phlegmy. Whatever it was, Marcia seemed to be coming down with it, too. And Trish had a nasty little tickle in the back of her throat that was making her cough, although so far it was a light cough that she could smother in a small hanky. "We've got to get Heck to a doctor," she said finally. Ed pulled into a service station and checked the map paperclip to the station wagon's sun visor. They were in Hammer Crossing, Kansas. "I don't know," he said. "Maybe we can at least find a doctor who will give us a referral." He finally found a doctor in Polliston who would look at Hector if they could get him there by 3. Polliston was off their route, 20 miles west of Hammer Crossing, but now the important thing was Hector. Ed was getting very worried about the boy. They were waiting in the outer office of Dr. Brendan Sweeney by 2 in the afternoon. By then, Ed was sneezing, too. Sweeney's waiting room was full. They didn't get in to see him until nearly 4 o'clock. Trish couldn't rouse Heck to more than a sludgy semi-consciousness, and she felt feverish herself. Only Stan Norris, age 9, still felt good enough to fidget. During their wait in Sweeney's office, they communicated the sickness to more than 25 people, including a matronly woman who just came in to pay her bill before going on to pass the disease to her entire bridge club. This matronly woman was Mrs. Robert Bradford, Sarah Bradford to the bridge club, Cookie to her husband and close friends. Sarah played well that night, possibly because her partner was Angela Dupre, her best friend. They seemed to enjoy a happy kind of telepathy. They won all three rubbers resoundingly, making a grand slam during the last. For Sarah, the only fly in the ointment was that she seemed to be coming down with a cold. It wasn't fair coming so soon on the heels of the last one. She and Angela went out for a quiet drink in a cocktail bar after the party broke up at 10. Angela was in no hurry to get home. It was David's turn to have the weekly poker game at their house, and she just wouldn't be able to sleep with all that noise going on. Unless she had a little self-prescribed sedative first, which in her case would be 2 slow gin fizzes. Sarah had a ward 8, and the two women rehashed the bridge game. In the meantime, they managed to infect everyone in the Polliston cocktail bar, including 2 young men drinking beer nearby. They were on their way to California, just as Larry Underwood and his friend Rudy Schwartz had once gone, to seek their fortunes. A friend of theirs had promised them jobs with a moving company. The next day, they headed west, spreading the disease, which came to be known on the West Coast as Captain Trips, as they went. Chapter 9. They set on him sometime after dusk, while he was walking up the shoulder of U.S. Route 27, which was called Main Street a mile back, where it passed through town. A mile or two up, he had been planning to turn west on 63, which would have taken him to the turnpike and the start of his long trip north. His senses had been dulled, maybe, by the 2 beers he had just downed, but he had known something was wrong. He was just getting around to remembering the 4 or 5 heavy-set townies down at the far end of the bar when they broke cover and ran at him. Nick put up the best fight he could, decking one of them and bloodying another's nose, breaking it, too, by the sound. For 1 or 2 hopeful moments, he thought there was actually a chance that he might win. The fact that he fought without making any sound at all was unnerving them a little. They were soft. Maybe they had done this before with no trouble, and they certainly hadn't expected a fight from this skinny kid with the knapsack. Then one of them caught him just over the chin, shredding his lower lip with a signet ring, and the warm taste of blood gushed into his mouth. He stumbled backward, and someone pinned his arms. He struggled wildly and got one hand free, just as a fist looped down into his face like a runaway moon and closed his right eye. He saw stars and felt his consciousness start to diffuse, drifting away to parts unknown. Scared, he struggled harder. The man with the signet ring was back in front of him now, and Nick, afraid of being cut again, kicked him in the belly. Signet ring's breath went out of him, and he doubled over, making a series of breathless woofing sounds, like a terrier with laryngitis. The others closed in. To Nick, they were only shapes now, beefy men, good old boys, they called themselves, in gray shirts with the sleeves rolled up to show their big, sun-freckled biceps. They wore blocky work shoes. Tangles of oily hair fell over their brows. In the last fading light of day, all of this began to seem like a malign dream. Blood ran in his open eye. The knapsack was torn from his back. Blows rained down on him, and he became a boneless, jittering puppet on a fraying string. Consciousness would not quite desert him. The only sounds were their out-of-breath gasps as they pistoned their fists into him, and the liquid twitter of a nightjar in the deep stand of pine close by. Signet ring had staggered to his feet. "Hold him by the har," he said. His arms were grasped. Someone else twined both hands into Nick's springy black hair. "Why don't he yell out?" one of the others asked, agitated. "Why don't he yell out, Ray?" "I told you not to use any names," Signet ring said. "I don't give a fuck why. I'm gonna mess him up. Sucker kicked me. Goddamn dirty fighter, that's what he is." The fist looped down. Nick jerked his head aside, and the ring furrowed his cheek. "Hold him," Ray said. The fist looped down, and Nick's nose became a squashed and dripping tomato. His breath clogged to a snuffle.
Consciousness was down to a narrow pencil beam. His mouth dropped open and he scooped in night air. The nightjar sang again, sweet and soulless. "Hold him," Ray said. "Hold him, goddammit." The fist looped down. Two of his front teeth shattered as the signet ring snowplowed through them. It was an agony he couldn't scream about. His legs unhinged and he sagged, held like a grain sack now by the hands behind him. "Ray, that's enough. You want to kill him?" "Hold him. Sucker kicked me. I'm going to mess him up." Then lights were splashing down the road, which was bordered here by underbrush and interlaced with huge old pines. "Oh, Jesus! Dump him! Dump him!" That was Ray's voice, but Ray was no longer in front of him. Nick was dimly grateful, but most of what little consciousness he had left was taken up by the agony in his mouth. He could taste flecks of his teeth on his tongue. Hands pushed him, propelling him out into the center of the road. Oncoming circles of light pinned him there like an actor on a stage. Brakes screamed. Nick pinwheeled his arms and tried to make his legs go, but his legs wouldn't oblige. They had given him up for dead. He collapsed on the composition surface, and the screaming sound of the brakes filled the world, and he waited numbly to be run over. At least it would put an end to the pain in his mouth. Then a splatter of pebbles struck his cheek, and he was looking at a tire which had come to a stop less than a foot from his face. He could see a small white rock embedded between two of the treads, like a coin held between a pair of knuckles. "Piece of quartz," he thought disjointedly, and passed out. When Nick came to, he was lying on a bunk. It was a hard one, but in the last 3 years or so, he had lain on harder. He struggled his eyes open with great effort. They seemed gummed shut, and the right one, the one that had been hit by the runaway moon, would only come to half-mast. He was looking at a cracked gray cement ceiling. Pipes wrapped in insulation zigzagged beneath it. Bisecting his field of vision was a chain. He raised his head slightly, sending a monstrous bolt of pain through it, and saw another chain running from the outside foot of the bunk to a bolt in the wall. He turned his head to the left, another bolt of pain, this one not quite so killing, and saw a rough concrete wall. Cracks ran through it. It had been extensively written on. Some of the writing was new, some old, most of it illiterate. "This place has bugs. Louis Dragonsky, 1977. I like it in my asshole. DTs can be fun. I still love you, Suzanne. This place sucks, S-U-X. Jerry. Clyde D. Fred, 1971. There were pictures of large dangling penises, gigantic breasts, crudely drawn vaginas. It all gave Nick a sense of place. He was in a jail cell. Carefully, he propped himself on his elbows, let his feet, clad in paper slippers, drop over the edge of the cot, and then swung up to a sitting position. The large economy-sized pane rocked his head again, and his backbone gave out an alarming creak. His stomach rolled alarmingly in his gut, and a fainting kind of nausea seized him, the most dismaying and unmanning kind, the kind that makes you feel like crying out to God to make it stop. Instead of crying out, he couldn't have done that, Nick leaned over his knees, one hand on each cheek, and waited for it to pass. After a while, it did. He could feel the band-aids that had been placed over the furrow on his cheek, and by wrinkling that side of his face a couple of times, he decided that some sawbones had sunk a couple of stitches in there. He looked around. He was in a small cell shaped like a saltines box, stood on end. Beyond the end of the cot was a barred door. Beside the cot was a toilet. Behind and above him, he saw this by craning his stiff neck very, very carefully, was a small barred window. After he had sat on the edge of the cot long enough to feel sure he wasn't going to pass out, he hooked the shapeless gray pajama pants he was wearing down around his knees, squatted on the can, and urinated for what seemed at least an hour. When he was finished, he stood up, holding onto the edge of the cot like an old man. He looked apprehensively into the bowl for signs of blood, but his urine had been clear. He flushed it away. He walked carefully over to the barred door and looked out into a short corridor. To his left was the drunk tank. An old man was lying on one of its five bunks, a hand like driftwood dangling on the floor. To the right, the corridor ended in a door that was wedged open. A shadow rose, danced on the propped-open door, and then a large man in khaki suntans walked into the corridor. He was wearing a Sam Brown belt and a big pistol. He hooked his thumbs into his pants pocket and looked at Nick for almost a full minute without speaking. Then he said, "When I was a boy, we caught ourselves a mountain lion up in the hills and shot it and then drug it 20 miles back to town over dirt hard pan. What was left of that creature when we got home was the sorriest-looking sight I ever saw. You the second sorriest, boy." Nick thought it had the feel of a prepared speech, carefully honed and treasured, saved for out-of-towners and vagues that occupied the barred saltines boxes from time to time. "What's your name, boy?" Nick put a finger to his swelled and lacerated lips and shook his head. He put a hand over his mouth, then cut the air with it in a soft diagonal hash mark and shook his head again. "What? You can't talk? What's this happy horse shit?" The words were spoken amiably enough, but Nick could not follow tones or inflections. He plucked an invisible pen from the air and wrote it. "You want pencil?" Nick nodded. "If you're mute, how come you don't have none of those cards?" Nick shrugged. He turned out his empty pockets. He balled his fists and shadowboxed the air, which sent another bolt of pain through his head and another wave of nausea through his stomach. He finished by tapping his own temples lightly with his fists, rolling his eyes up and sagging on the bars. Then he pointed to his empty pockets. "You were robbed." Nick nodded. The man in khaki turned away and went back to his office. A moment later, he returned with a dull pencil and a notepad. He thrust them through the bars. Written across the top of each note sheet was "Memo" and "From the desk of Sheriff John Baker." Nick turned the pad around and tapped the pencil eraser at the name. He raised questioning eyebrows. "Yeah, that's me. Who are you?" "Nick Andros," he wrote. He put his hand through the bars. Baker shook his head. "I ain't gonna shake with you. You deaf, too?" Nick nodded. "What happened to you tonight? Doc Soames and his wife almost ran you down like a woodchuck, boy." "Beat up and robbed. A mile or so from a roadhouse on Main Street, Zach's place." "That hangout's no place for a kid like you," Baker said. "You surely aren't old enough to drink." Nick shook his head indignantly. "I'm 22, he wrote. "I can have a couple of beers without getting beaten up and robbed for them, can't I?" Baker read this with a sourly amused look on his face. "It don't appear you can, and show you. What are you doing here, kid?" Nick tore the first sheet off the memo pad, crumpled it in a ball, and dropped it on the floor. Before he could begin to write his reply, an arm shot through the bars and a steel hand clutched his shoulder. Nick's head jerked up. "My wife neatens these cells," Baker said, "and I don't see any need for you to litter yours up. Go throw that in the John." Nick bent over, wincing at the pain in his back, and fished the ball of paper off the floor. He took it over to the toilet, tossed it in, and then looked up at Baker with his eyebrows raised. Baker nodded. Nick came back. This time he wrote longer, pencil flying over the paper. Baker reflected that teaching a deaf-mute kid to read and write was probably quite a trick, and this Nick Andros must have some pretty good equipment upstairs to have caught the hang of it. There were fellows here in Shoyo, Arkansas, that had never properly caught the hang of it, and more than a few of them hung out in Zach's. But you couldn't expect a kid who just blew into town to know that. Nick handed the pad through the bars. "I've been traveling around, but I'm not a vague. Spent today working for a man named Rich Ellerton about 6 miles west of here. I cleaned his barn and put a load of hay in his loft. Last week I was in Watts, Oklahoma, running fence. The men who beat me up got my week's pay." "You sure it was Rich Ellerton you was working for? I can check that, you know." Baker had torn off Nick's explanation, folded it to wallet photo size, and tucked it into his shirt pocket. Nick nodded. "You see his dog?" Nick nodded. "What kind was it?" Nick gestured for the pad. Big Doberman, he wrote, but nice, not mean. Baker nodded, turned away, and went back into his office. Nick stood at the bars, watching anxiously. A moment later, Baker returned with a big key ring, unlocked the holding cell, and pushed it back on its track. Come on in the office, Baker said. You want some breakfast? Nick shook his head, then made pouring and drinking motions. Coffee? Got that. You take cream and sugar? Nick shook his head. Take it like a man, huh? Baker laughed. Come on. In the outer office, Baker poured him a cup of black coffee out of a huge thermos. The sheriff's half-finished breakfast plate stood on his desk blotter, and he pulled it back to himself. Nick sipped the coffee. It hurt his mouth, but it was good. He tapped Baker on the shoulder, and when he looked up, Nick pointed to the coffee, rubbed his stomach, and winked soberly. Baker smiled. You better say it's good. My wife Jane puts it up. He tucked half a hard-fried egg into his mouth, chewed, and then pointed at Nick with his fork. You're pretty good, just like one of those pantomimers. Bet you don't have much trouble making yourself understood, huh? Nick made a seesawing gesture with his hand in midair. Come see, come saw. I ain't gonna hold you, Baker said, mopping up grease with a slice of toasted Wonder Bread. But I tell you what, if you stick around, maybe we can get the guy who did this to you. You game? Nick nodded and wrote, You think I can get my week's pay back? Not a chance, Baker said flatly. Nick nodded and shrugged. Putting his hands together, he made a bird flying away. How many were there? Baker asked. Nick held up four fingers, shrugged, then held up five. Think you could identify any of them? Nick held up one finger and wrote, Big and blonde, your size, maybe a little heavier, gray shirt and pants. He was wearing a big ring on third finger right hand, purple stone. That's what cut my face. As Baker read this, a change came over his face. First concern, then anger. Nick, thinking the anger was directed against him, became frightened again. Oh, Jesus Christ, Baker said. This here's a full commode slopping over for sure. You sure? Nick nodded reluctantly. Anything else? You see anything else? Nick thought hard, then wrote, Small scar on his forehead. Baker looked at the words. That's Ray Booth, he said. My brother-in-law. Thanks, kid. 5 a.m. and my day's wrecked already. Nick's eyes opened a little wider, and he made a cautious gesture of commiseration. Well, all right, Baker said, more to himself than to Nick. He's a bad actor, and Janie knows it. He beat her up enough times when they was kids together. Still, they're brother and sister, and I guess I can forget my loving for this week. Nick looked down, embarrassed. After a moment, Baker shook his shoulder so that Nick would see him speaking. It probably won't do any good anyway, he said. They'll just swear each other up. Your word against theirs. Did you get any licks in? Kicked this ray in the guts, Nick wrote. Got another one in the nose, might have broken it. Ray pals around with Vince Hogan, Billy Warner, and Mike Childress mostly, Baker said. I might be able to get Vince alone and break him down. He's as spineless as a jellyfish. If I could get him, I could go after Mike and Billy. Ray got that ring in a fraternity at LSU. He flunked out his sophomore year. He paused, drumming his fingers against the rim of his breakfast plate. I guess we could give it a go, kid, if you wanted to. But I warn you in advance, we probably couldn't get him. They as vicious and cowardly as a dog pack, but they're town boys and you're just a deaf-mute drifter. And if they got off, they'd come after you. Nick thought about it. In his mind, he kept coming back to the image of himself being shoved from one of them to the next like a bleeding scarecrow, and to Ray's lips forming the words, I'm gonna mess him up. Sucker kicked me. To the feel of his knapsack, that old friend of the last two wandering years, being ripped from his back. On a memo pad, he wrote and underlined two words. Let's try. Baker sighed and nodded. Okay, Vince Hogan works down to the sawmill. Well, that ain't just true. What he does mostly is fucks off. We'll take a ride down there about 9, if that's fine with you. Maybe we can get him scared enough to spill it. Nick nodded. How's your mouth? Doc Soames left some pills. He said it would probably be a misery to you. Nick nodded ruefully. I'll get him it. He broke off, and in Nick's silent movie world, he watched the sheriff explode several sneezes into his handkerchief. That's another thing, he went on, but he had turned away now, and Nick caught only the first word. I'm coming down with a real good cold. Jesus Christ, ain't life grand. Welcome to Arkansas, boy. He got the pills and came back to where Nick sat. Baker rubbed gently under the angle of his jaw. There was a definite painful swelling there. Swollen glands, coughing, sneezing. Yeah, it was shaping up to be a wonderful day. Chapter 10. Larry woke up with a hangover that was not too bad, a mouth that tasted as if a baby dragon had used it for a potty chair, and a feeling that he was somewhere he shouldn't be. The bed was a single, but there were two pillows on it. He could smell frying bacon. He sat up, looked out the windows at another gray New York day, and his first thought was that they had done something horrible to Berkeley overnight. Then last night began coming back, and he realized he was looking at Fordham, not Berkeley. He was in a second-floor flat on Tremont Avenue, not far from the concourse, and his mother was going to wonder where he had been last night. Had he called her, given her any kind of excuse, no matter how thin? He swung his legs out of bed and found the crumpled pack of Winston's with one crazy cigarette left in it. He lit it with a green plastic Bic lighter. It tasted like dead horse shit. Out in the kitchen, the sound of frying bacon went on and on, like radio static on the AM band. The girl's name was Maria, and she had said she was a oral hygienist or something. Larry didn't know how much she knew about hygiene, but she was great on oral. Maria had been a little overwhelmed to discover he was that Larry Underwood. At one point in the evening's festivities, hadn't they gone reeling around looking for an open record store so they could buy a copy of Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? He groaned very softly and tried to retrace yesterday from its innocuous beginnings to its frantic, gobbling finale. The Yanks weren't in town, he remembered that. His mother had been gone to work when he woke up, but she had left a Yankee schedule on the kitchen table along with a note. As you can see, the Yankees won't be in town until July 1st. They are playing a doubleheader the 4th of July. If you're not doing anything that day, why not take your mom to the ballpark? I'll buy the beer and hot dogs. There was a typical Alice Underwood P.S. Most of the kids you hung around with are gone now, and good riddance to that bunch of hoods, but I think Buddy Marks is working at that print shop on Stricker Avenue. Just thinking of that note was enough to make him wince. No dear before his name, no love before her signature. She didn't believe in phony stuff. The real stuff was in the refrigerator. Sometime while he had been sleeping off his long drive across country, she had gone out and stocked up on every goddamn thing in the world that he liked. Her memory was so perfect it was frightening. A Daisy canned ham. 2 pounds of real butter. How the hell could she afford that on her salary? 2 six-packs of Coke. Deli sausages. A roast of beef already marinating in Alice's secret sauce. And a gallon of Baskin-Robbins chocolate cheesecake ice cream in the freezer. The oral hygienist came in, wearing a pink nylon half-slip and nothing else. Hi, Larry, she said. She was short, pretty in a vague Sandra Dee sort of way, and her breasts pointed at him perkily without a sign of a sag. What was the old joke? She had a pair of 38s and a real gun. Ha-ha, very funny. He had come 3,000 miles to spend the night being eaten alive by Sandra Dee. Hi, he said, and got up. He was naked, but his clothes were at the foot of the bed. He began to put them on. I've got a robe you can wear if you want to. We're having kippers and bacon. Kippers and bacon? His stomach began to fold in on itself with horror. No, honey, I've got to run. Someone I've got to see.
Oh, hey, you can't just run out on me like that.
Really, it's important.
Well, I'm important, too.
She was starting to be strident, and that hurt Larry's head. "Your Bronx is showing love," he said.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
She planted her hands on her hips, and her breasts jiggled fetchingly. But Larry wasn't fetched. He stepped into his pants and buttoned them.
"So I'm from the Bronx. Does that make me black? What have you got against the Bronx?"
"Nothing," he said, and walked over to her in his bare feet.
"Listen, the somebody I have to meet is my mother. I just got into town 2 days ago, and I didn't call her last night or anything, did I?" he added hopefully. "You didn't call anybody," she said sullenly. "I just bet it's your mother."
He walked back to the bed and stuck his feet in his loafers.
"It is, really. She works in the chemical bank building as floor supervisor." "I bet you aren't the Larry Underwood that has that record either."
"You believe what you want. I have to run."
"You cheap prick," she flashed at him. "What am I supposed to do with all the stuff I cooked?"
"Throw it out the window."
She uttered a high squawk of anger and hurled the spatula at him.
On any other day of his life, it would have missed him. One of the first laws of physics was, to wit, a spatula will not fly a straight trajectory if hurled by an angry oral hygienist. Only this was the exception that proved the rule. Flip-flop, up and over, smash, right into Larry's forehead. It didn't hurt much. Then he saw 2 drops of blood fall on the throw rug as he bent over to pick the spatula up. He advanced 2 steps with the spatula in his hand.
"I ought to paddle you with this," he shouted at her. "Sure," she said, cringing back and starting to cry. "Why not? Big star, fucking run. I thought you were a nice guy. You ain't no nice guy."
Several tears ran down her cheeks, dropped from her jaw, and plopped onto her upper chest. Fascinated, he watched one of them roll down the slope of her right breast and perch on the nipple. It had a magnifying effect. He could see pores and 1 black hair sprouting from the inner edge of the aureole. "Jesus Christ, I'm going crazy," he thought wonderingly.